should currently be the only priority for EU authorities. The UK is approving jabs weeks ahead of the 27-country bloc. Secrecy surrounds the number of vaccines going to each EU nation and how many people have so far received the jab. The European Commission says it is working with the European Centre for Disease Control to set up an information website. And that cannot happen soon enough because a major criticism of the vaccination programme in the EU relates to a lack of data. It is simply impossible to scrutinise or compare the performances of member states. We have been talking to EU citizens in Brussels about the speed of the vaccine's rollout.
My father is 76. I don't know where it will be for him. It will be maybe in 4 or 5 months. That's quite slow.
It's not easy, yeah. It's too slow. I think the priorities are not the best one.
Trying to understand why it's so slow in EU. I don't know, maybe we need more testing to be sure of the vaccine.
Me, I really want to live like a normal person, the way we did. So if I have to be vaccinated, I will be vaccinated.
Cracks continue to appear within the EU's unity as countries move to secure vaccines independently of the European Commission. Adding to the woes is news that production of the Pfizer vaccine is being temporarily delayed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of people, including leaders and supporters of the far right, take to the streets of Vienna to protest against COVID restrictions.
This isn't the first protest of its kind here in Austria, and it comes as the country is in its third lockdown. That lockdown is expected to end on the 24th of January.
With hardly any masks in sight and no distance between them, demonstrators only booed and whistled when asked by the police to observe the safety rules. Many of the banners, signs and slogans repeated claims that the pandemic was part of a conspiracy in which the World Health Organization and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates were complicit.
Are you not worried about contracting the virus?
I'm not worried about the virus because it's not dangerous for 99.9% of the population. It's not dangerous. It's just dangerous for very old, very sick people. And yes, for these people, influenza too is dangerous. And COVID-19 is not more dangerous than influenza.
These claims have been strongly refuted by experts who cite evidence-based data to prove that COVID is far more deadly and significantly more contagious than seasonal flu. In fact, with the emergence of new variants, experts believe we're now in the most dangerous time of the pandemic. Demonstrators also shouted slogans against the government's vaccination program that's already well underway.
The people should decide for ourselves. Yes. And not because the law is decided for us. We want to decide, is this our body, is this our brain, our life, and not the life of the government.
With the rate of new infections still considered way too high, the government is expected to announce a further tightening of restrictions. Omaleski, Vienna.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend. The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down. Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people, and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. And so you're looking at something where the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Italy topped 1 million COVID jabs since the start of the vaccination campaign on December 31st, according to the latest data. Out of over 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine delivered across the country since December 27, more than 60% have already been injected, the highest number of first doses administered in the EU. However, some Italian media have been warning in recent days about an increasing number of medics and health workers not willing to be vaccinated.
Vaccination rate among health workers is quite high. However, about 10% of medical staff remain very skeptical. The lack of testing is one of people's main concerns. We are observing the effects of the vaccine while it's being administered.
A poll released in mid-December caused surprise in Italy by showing that one-third of the population were not willing to be vaccinated, along with half of nurses and other health workers.
I have my reservations over the vaccine because the matter has not been discussed much yet. I would have injected only if it becomes obligatory.
New polls are showing the scenario seems to have changed in recent days, with more Italians willing to receive the coronavirus vaccine. Medics promoting anti-vaccination propaganda had been warned or disciplined by doctors' associations.
Doctors' guilds in Italy have been conducting inquiries into medics accused of unwarranted criticism of vaccinations. Tens of medics have been punished with measures ranging from warnings to 2-month suspensions.
Doctors' guilds' actions being timely and appropriate. Unfortunately, some medics should be trained on how to express their views on social platforms, as they aren't aware of the consequences of their inflammatory posts.
Meanwhile, a joint report by the Health Ministry and the Higher Health Institute is warning the COVID-19 epidemic in Italy risks becoming uncontrolled as the virus RT reproduction number has been increasing for 5 weeks straight. The country's COVID-19 death toll has risen to over 81,000. Max Civili, Rome.
Across the United States, local newspapers are running the same headlines. A record-breaking year in murders. Not since the ruinous crack cocaine epidemic have poor areas been so culturally and emotionally devastated by violence. The coronavirus lockdowns in the United States were widely criticized for being enacted without any apparent consideration as to how it would affect their lower classes. Adding lockdowns on top of bad housing, lack of access to food, police brutality, and other endemic problems put unbearable stress on those who could least afford it. The tremendous economic suffering also decreased the revenue of America's rampant gang activity, which many allege is aided by corrupt cops, and sparked increased fighting over market share. But Chicago, the nation's third largest city, is indicative. Almost half of all shootings here took place in just 7% of neighborhoods which are dominated by poor African and Latino Americans. These areas don't just lack schools, jobs, and health care, they even lack sidewalks and garbage cans, because both private banks and the government refuse to make even basic investments.
The solutions remain what they have always been. The solutions remain investment into neighborhoods. The solutions remain accepting authentic leadership that people will listen to, because these leaders have the best interest of the people in mind versus leaders who cooperate and who are co-opted by the system. If you really want change, you have to do something different. That means there has to be more focus on the value of human life, less focus on the value of stock market.
But the blame can't be put all on Corona. 75 of the 100 largest cities in the country saw an increase in fatal shootings in the first quarter of 2020. American poverty and instability have soared since the 2008 economic crisis, but America's disregard for the poor of all colors goes back much further.
The solution remains in America looking into the mirror and seeing the ugly side of who she is and making a decision to change, making a decision about where to put money, making a decision about how much money to be placed, making a decision about holding police officers and other powerful figures in government and in society accountable for their wrongdoing, and really caring for the development of the American people versus those who are at the top of this oligarchy, which poses as a democracy.
The highest year-to-year increase in murders ever recorded across urban America was 13%. 2020 saw an estimated increase of nearly 40%. The decision of the nation's political elites to not release a second household stimulus until after the presidential election is being widely blamed for increasing the unstable conditions which inevitably provoked the record tragedies of 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Washington, D.C., the U.S. capital city, preparing for the inauguration of the next president on January 20th. However, what is most noticeable across the city is heightened security. Roads around the White House are blocked. Many public areas and businesses closed off until after the inauguration. Capitol Hill is being guarded by police, National Guards, and other law enforcement officers. In order to move between the White House and the Congress building, citizens need to pass through strict security checks. Officials are even pushing for more security.
We have a special responsibility that there is a peaceful transition of power in our country. We're proud in Washington to host the federal government, and we want to make sure that event is peaceful.
Tensions are running high in light of the January 6th seizure of the Capitol building by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. Earlier this week, the House of Representatives impeached Trump for inciting what it called the insurrection that left five people dead. A police officer was among those killed. U.S. intelligence reports gathered from social media platforms suggest that authorities are tracking thousands of new threats against politicians ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration ceremony. These threats include calls for the assassination of Democrat lawmakers, usage of explosives and weaponry, and million militia marches. Former FBI Director James Comey has also warned of a very serious risk of violence during Biden's inauguration. D.C. citizens are very concerned, too.
It's the biggest security threat, internal domestic security threat, we've ever had since our Civil War. Of course, I think that that is a huge security threat.
More than 25,000 National Guards have been deployed to Washington, D.C. The Pentagon says they are authorized to carry weapons and make arrests to provide security. other American state capitals are on alert too. Trump's final days in office are also marked with political tensions in different layers of the U.S. government. The Senate is clashing over his impeachment trial. The House is calling for the prosecution of the lawmakers accused of helping in the Capitol Hill unrest. That comes as Vice President Mike Pence is trying to fulfill Trump's duties. Trump has even refused to participate in the inauguration of his successor, Biden. All these make the swearing-in of the 46th president of the U.S. a ceremony like no other in the American history.
Turkey started its massive COVID-19 vaccination program after the end of a 14-day testing period by Turkey's Medicines and Medical Devices Agency, which approved the jab. The first shipment Sinovac vaccine, consisting of 3 million doses, arrived in Turkey late last month. Turkey is scheduled to receive a total of 50 million doses. More than 300,000 healthcare workers took the vaccine across the country, with data from the Health Ministry revealing that Turkey has 1.1 million health workers who will be vaccinated within a month from now. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Health Minister Fahrettin Koca and several members of the Science Board were the first ones to get vaccinated.
We aim to vaccinate all of our citizens as soon as possible. The number of vaccines in the first stage is clear. Now another 25 to 13 million doses will come in the period ahead. We want to continue this rapidly. I got vaccinated as well.
Those who were vaccinated will take the second dose of the vaccine after 28 days.
The coronavirus spread needs to be contained, and the Turkish government has already managed to contain it through various measures. And now, with the arrival of the first batch of the vaccine, it seems that Turkey will be ready to fold this page by the end of February, as the president announced. By that time, everyone will be vaccinated.
Preliminary studies involving more than 7,000 volunteers in Turkey showed corona vaccine to be 91.25% effective. Turkey has reported about 2.34 million infections and around 23,000 deaths. The country has imposed weekend lockdowns and evening curfews to fight the surge in the cases. Turkey is set to carry out the vaccination in four stages, with health workers, elderly, disabled, and adults living in crowded places to take the vaccine in the first stage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The political battle in the United States of America is between two parties of capital, united by far more than divides them. The shadow play of U.S. politics is the enervating, antagonistic confrontation of identities. While ordinary Americans get stuck into a mutual tribal loathing by corporate media that profits from this theater of hate, the elite enjoys a free hand to pillage the planet and the commons. Dear listeners, these were the words of Jonathan Cook, writer, which is published in an article titled, "Trump May Be on Trial, But the System That Produced Him Will Be Acquitted." Stay tuned for more. It is a fitting end to 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House. On one side, Trump's endless stoking of political grievances and claims that November's presidential election was stolen from him spilled over into a mob storming the U.S. Capitol. They did so in the forlorn hope of disrupting the certification process of Electoral College vote, which formally declared his opponent, Joe Biden. On the other side, the Democratic Party instituted a second unprecedented impeachment process, in the slightly less forlorn hope that Trump leaves office disgraced and humiliated, foreclosing any possibility he can run again in 2024. Barely concealing its alliance with the incoming Biden administration, Silicon Valley has shut down Trump's social media megaphone. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has lobbied the Joint Chiefs of Staff to cut an unhinged Trump out of the chain of command, in a move that was reportedly rejected out of hand by Pentagon officials because, they told the New York Times, it would amount to a military coup. And Biden, who boasts that he was the author of the Patriot Act years before 9/11, has been touting a new domestic terrorism bill, as though the U.S. did not already have a plethora of ways to crack down on dissent of both the legitimate and the illegitimate varieties. With this as the backdrop, Washington, D.C. is designating the inauguration of Biden a national special security event. And this is not just the latest sign that the U.S. political system has degenerated into tawdry theater. It is growing evidence that U.S. politics is developing into a permanent confrontation between two authoritarian tribes. Both are convinced that the other side is an un-American, perverting the true republic. Both are unwilling to compromise, believing they share no common ground. And ultimately, both are fighting for a rotten cause. This is not a divide between ethical and unethical politics. This clash is now a bitter grudge match. It is civil war by other means. Not only is the chasm between these rival camps widening, but the real criminals are making off, as they always do, with the loot. Each tribe has been coalescing for a while, now around the center of gravity. On the Republican side, that became clear with the emergence of the Tea Party and the birther movement during Barack Obama's tenure. But it took Trump's election as president in 2016 to create a proper oppositional center of gravity on the other side. Those in the Democrat tribe who now disdain Trump and his supporters for their desperate refusal to accept November's result overlook how they greeted Trump's victory in 2016. They struggled to accept the legitimacy of that outcome too, even if they did not resort to the overt violence of the mob at the Capitol. It began with arguments that while Trump might have won the Electoral College vote, he lost the popular vote. 4 years ago, the Electoral College also faced self-serving accusations that it had disenfranchised the majority. The Democrat tribe took to the streets as well in protest marches in cities across the U.S. under the banner of the resistance, denying Trump was their president. That was understandable, given his personal behavior and the policies he advocated. But it did not end there. The disavowal of the Trump presidency quickly regressed into a dangerous narrative, one that has never properly gone away, despite the dearth of evidence to support it. Anything that had damaged Clinton, including emails showing that the Democratic leadership rigged its own primaries to make sure she was the party's candidate rather than Bernie Sanders, got sucked into that vast conspiracy theory. That included the messenger of these bad tidings, WikiLeaks, and its founder, Julian Assange. For years, the Democrat tribe has invested its considerable energies in fruitless efforts to prove its theory, including the first bid to remove Trump through an entirely self-defeating impeachment process. None of this could be justified politically. It was a Democrat counterpoint to Trump's MAGA slogan, Make America Great Again. Democrats promised a much less catchy SAPD, Save America from President Deplorable. For this tribe, Trump was an illegitimate president from the outset. One chosen election to the highest office in the land revealed something unwholesome about their country they preferred to avert their gaze from, because it might implicate them too. Removing Trump largely eclipsed the struggle to improve the lives of ordinary Americans. The obsession with Trump above everything else seemingly rationalized any means, fair or foul, to be rid of him. Few thought about how this would look to his supporters or to those not already safely ensconced in one or other tribe. Had they wished to understand, they needed only look to the storming of Capitol recently. This mood is not likely to dissipate. The two political tribes are locked in an antagonistic struggle, mirroring each other's moves, each other's grudges, each other's sense of victimhood. Much more unites them than they would ever care to admit. What we see here is the culmination of a festering culture war stoked by an unhealthy investment by both sides in a simple-minded and highly divisive identity politics. Much has correctly been made of the white supremacism of the most loyal sections of Trump's tribe, and that was on show again during the invasion of the Capitol. The Confederate flag and neo-Nazi slogans are all indicators of a toxic politics of white grievance that may be less articulated but is still felt by a wider swath of Trump-supporting constituency. This ugly identity politics is rightly rejected by the other tribe, but is nonetheless mirrored in its equally deep commitment to identity politics. The progressive coalition of identities at the core of the Democratic Party may be more reassuring to modern sensibilities, but has served in practice to accentuate two parts of Trump tribe and the supposed threat to their white identity. This is not to equate the justified struggle of Black Lives Matter against endemic racism, including in the police, with the reactionary forces seeking to preserve some notion of white privilege. It is to simply observe that when the political field of battle exclusively revolves around identity, then one cannot be surprised if each side continues to frame its struggle in precisely those terms. Those who live by the identity sword are likely to die by that same sword. The Trump tribe won their president, and the Republican Party more generally to guarantee a white supremacism they fear is being eroded as the Democrat Party flaunts its progressive multicultural credentials. The Democrat tribe, meanwhile, wants to challenge the old order, and most especially reactionary institutions like local police forces that have been an oppressive bulwark against chance. This dynamic can lead only to permanent confrontation, bitterness, and alienation. The political battle in the United States is between two parties of capital united by far more than divides them. The shadow play of U.S. politics is the enervating antagonistic confrontation of identities described. While ordinary Americans get stuck into a mutual tribal loathing by a corporate media that profits from this theater of hate, the elite enjoys a free hand to pillage the planet and the commons. While Americans fixate on the identities that have been crafted to divide them, while they remain immersed in the surface of politics, while they are distracted from the real battle lines, those elites prosper. Political paralysis may not harm the establishment, but it is profoundly damaging to American citizens, the 99%, when their communities are being ravaged by a pandemic, when their economies are in meltdown, when the planet is on the brink of ecological collapse. The system that produced Trump will be acquitted by Congress, by the new president, by Wall Street, by the corporate media. It is Americans who will pay the price.
The debate.
U.S. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has told France, avoid absurd nonsense about Tehran's nuclear work, in reference to a claim by France that Tehran was in the process of building up its nuclear weapons. Why is France making such a claim without proof? The French FM, meanwhile, also stated that Tehran and Washington should return to the 2015 nuclear agreement. In this edition of The Debate, we will look at the JCPOA 2021 from all angles, from the east to the west, and see whether there is a chance for it to be revived or not.
The war of wars continues between Iran and France over violating the 2015 nuclear agreement. On Sunday, Iran's foreign minister lashed out at his French counterpart after he accused the Islamic Republic of building up a nuclear weapons capacity. Mohammad Javad Zarif dismissed Jean-Yves Le Drian's claim as absurd nonsense. Zarif blamed France for destabilizing West Asia by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. He said Europeans have done nothing to save the agreement.
E3 leaders who rely on signature of OFAC functionaries to carry out their obligations under JCPOA have done zilch to maintain JCPOA. Remember Emmanuel Macron's stillborn initiative or UK non-payment of court-ordered debt? JCPOA is alive because of Iran, not E3.
The French foreign minister's allegation came less than 2 weeks after Iran started enriching uranium to 20% purity. France accused Iran of breaching the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. But Iran argues that its uranium enrichment activity is a response to non-compliance of the European signatories. Experts say France's allegations are part of a U.S.-Israeli propaganda campaign. In May 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the landmark agreement, following which Washington left no stone unturned to impose the toughest sanctions ever on Iran, claiming that Tehran violated the JCPOA without offering any evidence. This contradicts numerous reports from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which fully confirmed Tehran's commitment to its nuclear obligations. Conversely, it was Iran which has been critical of the lack of courage and political will on the part of the European signatories, namely Britain, France, and Germany, for not fulfilling their share of the agreement. Many believe Tehran is basically reciprocating what the Europeans have been doing concerning the Iran nuclear deal.
This is a sign that having anti-Iran activities, killing Iranian scientists, will have a cost. And this will continue as long as the policies of maximum pressure campaign continues under this sign.
Iran argues that in the wake of U.S. withdrawal, European countries failed to do enough to make up for Washington's unilateral withdrawal and ensuing reimposition of sanctions. Tehran complains that Europeans made no practical effort to stand up to Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian nation. Now, with Biden taking office on Wednesday, it is for the U.S. to put an end to its malign policy toward Tehran and return to the agreement, and for the European allies to abide by their commitments and pay their share of the accord. Otherwise, Iran says any renegotiation of the pact is just out of the question.
Joining us to discuss this further, former United Nations weapons inspector and author of Deal Breaker, Donald Trump and the Unmaking of the Iran Nuclear Deal, Scott Ritter joins us from New York. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Scott Ritter, and ask your reaction about this French claim that Tehran was in the process of building up its nuclear weapons. And let me quote what Jean-Yves Le Drian has said, quote, "This has to stop because Iran, and I say this clearly, is in the process of acquiring nuclear weapons capacity."
Look, from the very start, the problem that many in the West and Israel have had with Iran's nuclear program is that it allows Iran access to processes which, although Iran claims is used for exclusively civilian purposes, peaceful purposes, are dual capable. This includes the enrichment of uranium, the centrifuges that Iran has installed. If you can enrich uranium to 3.5%, to 20%, you can enrich it to 90%, 98%, and therefore you could produce a nuclear weapon if that indeed was your intention and you had other capabilities that you were pursuing. France has picked up on the conversion of uranium into metal. If you're going to build a nuclear weapon, a nuclear device, this is a process you need to do. But it is also a process that Iran has used in the past to convert 20% enriched uranium into metal plates that are used as fuel for a research reactor in Tehran that produces medical isotopes. France knows this, so it's irresponsible rhetoric on the part of France to take a process which Iran has used in the past, which Iran agreed to under the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action to cease, but which Iran says under Article 26 it's allowed to undertake, given the fact that Europeans are in non-compliance of the agreement. It's wrong for France to call this a weaponization process. If France was being honest, they'd recognize that by converting its 20% enriched uranium to metal plates for fuel, Iran is actually making it much more difficult for Iran to pursue a nuclear weapons capability if it was so inclined to do so, because you'd have to reconvert that metal plate back into uranium hexafluoride to put back into the centrifuges to increase the enrichment percentage. So France is just dead wrong on this. Iran is behaving in a manner which is consistent with its stated intent of having a peaceful nuclear program. That's all.
Elijah McNair, so we have our guest there stating this, and he got into the technicalities of it. And I'm going to say one of the phrases that I picked up on from what he said, Scott Ritter said, that was irresponsible rhetoric coming from France. Why has France chosen to use, quote, irresponsible rhetoric, and why at this time?
I agree with what Scott just said. And if I may add to it, that Europe, particularly France, Germany, and the UK, have no right to ask Iran to commit to the JCPOA when they have not honored their part of the agreement of the 2015 nuclear deal. So when they start honoring the agreement and they free themselves from the U.S. administration's power and control and hegemony, then they can start to ask and question Iran why they are abiding or non-abiding with the nuclear deal that they are not respecting. And what we see is Iran is always on the defensive and all the time saying, no, we're not doing it. No, what your accusation is not founded. We still respect the JCPOA. We're still within the terms. Which terms? These terms have been revoked by the U.S. administration in 2018, and Europe did not honor its agreement and pull out all the companies from Iran for fear of the U.S. sanctions on their company and on their banks. So every single commitment that they've signed in 2015 was not honored. So I don't understand why Iran is always defending itself and saying, no, we're not doing it. We're reaching the 20% for nuclear scientific purposes, for medicine. And they always saying, no, we're still within the JCPOA. We're still announcing everything we are doing. We allow the inspector to come in, but Iran has a decision from the parliament now, and there are steps that Iran, the government of Iran, is forced to respect, and this is going to be a gradual withdrawal from the JCPOA, regardless what Le Drian is saying, because what he's saying is just the voice of Trump and the voice of the U.S. administration that shredded the agreement in 2018 unlawfully. So I don't think that the French foreign minister or the German minister have the right to ask Iran what they are doing. If they want to respect the JCPOA, they want to honor their share, they come to Iran, they do their part, and they check if Iran is also respecting it.
Well, what happened, Scott Ritter, I'm sorry, we have to do a little bit of a background check here quickly, and I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to ask the question from you. You know, we had the JCPOA happen when it did, and Iran never really saw the rewards of it, even when it was agreed on. And we saw how Iran then, after the U.S. pullout, announced gradual withdrawals. And then we got to the point where there was that assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Iran's parliament reacted, or I guess they stated that, that it's going to restart the 20% uranium enrichments legislated by Iran's parliaments. And Iran also said the IAEA was notified about this. And our remedial action, as Iran stated, conforms fully with paragraph 36 of the JCPOA after years of noncompliance by the JCPOA participants. Now, the point that Iran has capitalized on this, and I'm going to state this boldly, Iran's foreign minister has said, our measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by all. Why isn't this point being picked up?
Well, the reason why this point isn't being picked up is because it doesn't fit the narrative that is prominent in the West. The narrative in the West is that Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapons program, which it unilaterally stopped in 2003. And some in the West say that Iran was continuing to pursue aspects of this nuclear weapons program up until 2007, 2009, and that the JCPOA was the only way the West had to stop Iran's nuclear weapons program in its tracks. The JCPOA bought the West at least a year's worth of advance notice should Iran violate the JCPOA and start doing things in the nuclear enrichment and nuclear development program that could be conducive towards building this hypothetical nuclear weapon. So the West's narrative is all about a Iranian nuclear weapons program, which nobody has proven to exist. Iran denies, and there's no evidence out there that one ever exists, but that's all they talk about. Therefore, when Iran undergoes actions, which it is permitted to do under Article 36 of the JCPOA, when confronted with demonstrable noncompliance by state parties to this agreement, being Europe, instead of interpreting it as Iran doing what it is legally allowed to do, they panic and say, wait a minute, that one-year breakout buffer that we had built no longer exists. Iran now could produce enough enriched uranium in a period of weeks, months, to have a nuclear bomb. And that's all they talk about. That's all they're concerned about. They don't recognize that everything Iran has done and is doing today, it was doing prior to the JCPOA being signed. That Iran was very easily able to transition from what it was doing prior to the JCPOA to conformity and compliance with the JCPOA, and it would be able to do that today if indeed all the state parties, all the signatories to the agreement were in compliance. Should the United States return and lift the sanctions, should Europe start abiding by its obligations for trade, Iran would be able to rapidly return to compliance as it did in 2015. This is not rocket science. I mean, it is nuclear science, but it's no nuclear science. We know what needs to be done. Iran knows what needs to be done. The world knows what needs to be done, but it doesn't fit the narrative of the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon, which drives many of the nations who entered into the JCPOA. It motivates them. They fear a nuclear weapons capability, and anything Iran does to deviate from the restrictions of the JCPOA only feeds the the fear in these countries that Iran is somehow rushing towards developing a nuclear weapon. It says it doesn't want. There's no evidence that it exists. And simply speaking, it couldn't produce today, even if it wanted to.
Okay, one point that needs to be really also highlighted here, and I think it's really taken very lightly. It's not really reflected in the West, given the weight that it should, Elijah Magnier. And that is what Iran's leader has said, always denying pursuing nuclear weapons, that he has said it's purely for civilian purposes, and Iran's leader to have issued a fatwa, a decree, banning the production, proliferation, and the use of weapons of mass destruction, WMDs. This is not really something that is brought onto the table. We know that the leader has said that these weapons are religiously haram and forbidden. Do you think that the U.S. takes that into consideration at all in the bigger picture?
I think the problem in the West here is they think Iran is open for negotiation and is bluffing. So this is why they are talking about changing and altering the JCPOA by including the missile program and the relationship between Iran and its allies. And we all the time have these discussions that people in the West are convinced that there is a room for the negotiation, that it is like the Iran skillful selling of a carpet, and that they can negotiate all the time and try to squeeze Iran even more. That's not true. What they don't realize is the JCPOA has been negotiated for 10 years and it is as it is, take it or leave it. And I think Iran is doing very well by increasing its measure and coming a little bit out of the JCPOA slowly but surely to show its intention and its determination to those who do not understand in the West that this is no room for negotiation and it should happen fast and it should happen before the end of February. And I think there is another way to look at things. So if we look at Israel and its nuclear bombs and we look at the missiles around Iran and all the 15 U.S. bases, all armed with all sorts of missiles, so why we don't address these when we talk about what Iran has as a missile program that is made to defend itself, because in the last decades, Iran never started a war against any country, particularly neighboring countries. So The double standard and the different way to look at Iran and to look at what Europe is doing, not doing, and how the U.S. shredded the deal is always going to be a focus on what Iran is not doing and is doing, and disregarding what Europe and the U.S. are not honoring.
Okay. Well, you talked about the missiles, and Scott Ritter, our guest there, mentioned the U.S. military bases, not to mention Israel, that it possesses nuclear weapons, even though it doesn't say it does. And you have all these different U.S. allies that have weapons, and many have outright stated that military option is on the table. At the same time, Iran, just days ago, showed off its military might in one particular instance, an underground missile storage facility. Now, Iran has stated its missile program is for deterrence. This is something that the West, in particular the U.S., if it comes back to the deal, and also the E3, want to discuss. Iran has said, we're not going to have that. That's a red line. We're not going to discuss it. Do you think then it's a non-starter, that this so-called negotiation, if it does happen, will not even take off the ground?
Look, I'll say this as an American who is pretty familiar with the mindset in Washington, D.C. About policymakers, not experts, but policymakers. We don't understand Iran, and we don't respect Iran. You asked a question earlier about the fatwa issued by the Supreme Leader. Barack Obama, near the end of his administration, said, yeah, you know, we understand there's a fatwa, and maybe that carries some weight. Maybe that carries some weight. Iran is an Islamic republic, and the supreme leader is the supreme jurisprudence. I don't think we understand what would happen to the credibility of Islam in an Islamic republic if the highest religious figure was exposed to be a liar and blaspheming in the name of Islam. We don't understand why the issuance of a fatwa is so important and so critical and must be respected. You know, I look, I'm an old Ronald Reagan arms control guy, trust but verify. But I trust the Supreme Leader when he says, we don't have any intention of developing this because it's haram, it's forbidden. The same thing, we don't recognize the fact that Iran is a democracy. We don't respect the parliament. We don't respect the will of the parliament. We don't understand that the parliament has a vote. Parliament has a say. And so when parliament passes these laws, we say, oh, that's nothing. The Supreme Leader is the final arbiter. Maybe, but parliament does have a voice. And therefore, when Iran says, because I'm laying this as a foundation, when Iran says our missiles are our deterrents, we don't respect that. We don't respect Iran. But we know it's the truth. Look, Donald Trump, on at least two occasions in the last year, lobbied for a military strike against Iran's nuclear program. And he was told both times by the Pentagon, in no uncertain terms, that if we do this, all Hades will break out in the Middle East, and Iran will exact a retribution on not only American military installations, but the industrial facilities, oil production facilities of our neighbors, of its neighbors, of our regional allies, of Israel. And if anything about the Assad attack, the attack on the American facility in Iraq, the al-Assad base, if that drove home any point, is that Iran has the ability to deliver precision-guided munitions on American installations, and there's literally nothing we can do to stop them. I'm not saying we're going to lose the war, but the Pentagon said it would take us 5 to 6 months to build up sufficient military force to prevail militarily against Iran. In the meantime, they destroy the global economy. Why do they do this? Because they have precision-guided munitions. They have the medium-range missiles. Iran's not going to give that up. If it weren't for these missiles, the United States would have bombed Iran already. So already the missiles have proven their deterrence value. If it weren't for these missiles, Israel may have bombed Iran already. But Israel will not bomb Iran because they understand what will happen to Israel should they do so. These missiles are essential for Iran's defense, national security. They have extreme proven deterrence capability, and Iran will never give them up, ever. And it's ludicrous for the United States to insist that they do, especially given the fact that we pour so much military power into the region. You know, we're asking Iran to sheathe its sword while we keep our sword out, hanging over their head. It's ridiculous.
Okay. I guess that's going to do it for a debate. Unfortunately, we're just fresh out of time, unfortunately. Let me thank our guest, Elijah Magnier, who is a journalist and political analyst. Thank you.